Today, maybe for the whole week, if not longer, I will be covering superconductivity, mainly theories of the Bodding-Cooper-Schreiber, also known as BCS, Landau-Ginzburg, and so on. So before we begin, let me remind you one thing we said last time when we were trying to justify the Landau-Fermi liquid theory, especially the existence of the long-lived quasi-particles. We considered a particular type of interaction, or if you like, a scattering channel. So for Fermi liquid theory. So the type of interaction, if you consider second order process, let's say in some perturbation theory, looks like this. If I have a particle here and nothing else in the field Fermi C, obviously, then I can think about a scattering like this. So I scatter a particle from K to K, what did I use? Some K minus Q or something. But then I put a particle that's originally inside the Fermi C, K prime, to another particle state at K prime plus Q. Right. So we argued last time, because of the phase-based constraint, that this kind of scattering becomes less and less effective. As K approaches the Fermi wave vector. Okay. And as a result, we have long-lived quasi-particle. With lifetime proportional to C square, the energy square, which is much less than the energy itself. Okay. And this essentially, at the end of the day, implies that this interaction doesn't really do much, as long as you go to low enough energy. But actually, that's not the end of the story. Turns out, there is another interaction channel that I didn't tell you about last time. That channel is now known as BCS, sometimes known as the BCS channel. I mean, everything here will be BCS-ish. Oh, by the way, BCS refers to Bardeen-Cooper-Schreiber. So what is this channel? What is this kind of interaction? Well, now you imagine a different thing. So you have a field Fermi C. Okay. But now you put a particle at, let's say, K, slightly out of the Fermi C. But then you also put another particle at minus K. Now you consider this kind of scattering. This K goes to, for example, K prime. But then by momentum conservation, this minus k has to go to minus k prime. Now there is no phase-based constraint. Remember, this kind of process penalizes you a lot because you want this k prime to be within the Fermi surface, but not too deep within. Otherwise, you can't have momentum conservation. Likewise, you want this k minus q to be also out of the Fermi surface, but not too much outside. And then you end up getting a factor of k minus kf square factor that penalizes you for this kind of process if k minus kf is small. But you don't get such a penalizing factor here at all. Okay? In fact, you can see that you have essentially an entire shell of momentum states that you can scatter to without causing you any energy. Okay? As long as, for example, that the mod of k prime is same as k. There are infinitely many such states. Okay. So this is not penalized by phase-based constraint. Okay. So this can potentially do something non-trivial. So the lecture today will basically be asking about what kind of effect this kind of interaction could have. So let me write down a toy model of such interaction. So if you write down a generic interaction, let's say electron interacting with each other via, for example, the Coulomb repulsion, it will contain a term that looks like this, among many other things. Okay? So generically, this will this term will be there. So let's cook up a simple model that contains only such term, because most of the other terms won't be as interesting. So let me write down a very idealized Hamiltonian equal to let me do it in three dimensions. So many of the things we said we'll be saying today almost works for two dimensions, but definitely not in one dimension. So let's do 3D. Okay. So U is the interaction strength. So now let me, pretty much for the first time in this course, finally remember that electrons carry spin half. So they're spin up, spin down. For most of the other stories we talked about earlier, that's not important, but for this story it is. So let me put spin back. Okay. So what is this? This process describes exactly this, except I also require that they form a singlet. So this one is, for example, if this is up, this is down. Or if this is down, this is up. The superposition comes with a minus sign to ensure that both this and this are spin singlets. Okay. Otherwise, it describes exactly this process, right? Annihilating a pair of electrons at opposite momentum that forms a spin singlet, create another pair at some other momentum, but still with total momentum zero, and spin singlet. And of course, in general, when I write down such a term, this U can depend on K and K prime. And let's make a very simple model, which is what BCS did. Let's say that this U KK prime is a constant U if the energy, the absolute value of the energy, which is defined by the total energy minus the kinetic energy minus the chemical potential, if you remember, if both this are smaller than some cutoff value. Let me call it omega d. In the context of actual BCS model, this will be the bifrequency. But think of it as some cutoff energy scale. The only requirement is I want this cutoff energy scale to be much smaller than Fermi energy. So let me remind you, Ck is if I'm sufficiently close to Fermi surface, so this energy is much smaller than the Fermi energy, this number is basically the Fermi velocity times k minus kf. Okay? And it could be positive or negative. And zero otherwise. So what does it mean? It means that there is a thin shell around the Fermi surface. So in momentum space, this scale, let me call it gamma, is roughly omega d over vf. Okay? So essentially, only electrons within this momentum shell sees this interaction. Right? So this interaction can bring two states of opposite momentum, but within this shell, to another two states of opposite momentum, but still within this shell. And out of the shell, things are like, basically like free electrons. Okay. So this is like almost the simplest possible model that captures this kind of process. Okay. And it turns out to be an amazingly good model for many simple metals. Okay. And our task today is basically try to solve the Hamiltonian that's like so this term plus the kinetic term. So let me remind you, the kinetic term looks like Ck times C up, Ck up plus C K down, Ck down. Okay, so this is the model we want to solve. So how do you solve it? Well, you can't. So you have to make some approximation. So this is a place where it's a good opportunity for you to learn something called mean field approximation. By the way, have you seen this in some sort of things like this in STEMAC?
We heard his name.
Sorry?
We heard the name. I don't know if it's the same thing.
Well, in STEMAC, when you have this, you replace one of this by this number. So have you seen that? Okay. Yeah. So it's basically that, but in a slightly, the symbols look slightly fancier. So the idea is, you replace things like this, I mean, with a bunch of indices, obviously, by something like this. Okay. So the starting assumption is this kind of operator may gain a non-trivial expectation value. And then you can do this replacement. Of course, you can do it almost exactly. For example, you can say this is plus C dagger minus C dagger, C dagger. C minus C. Right. If you do this rewriting, that's an exact rewriting. Right. It's literally this is just a number. Then the exact rewriting by itself is going to be useless. The approximation is that you imagine this term has a small effect, and then throw it away. So if you want, after you've done things self-consistently, you can go back and ask, what's the effect of this term? Is it going to destabilize my theory and totally invalidate my approximation? Right. Of course, in this case, it doesn't. Oh, it turns out if you're in 1D, this term will come in and ruin your approximation. But we're not in 1D. We're good. So that's the spirit. And now let's look at that theory a little bit carefully. And let's define this object, delta. So u times the factor that guarantees that I'm within that momentum shell of omega d. And then down minus c k up. So the thing is, if you look at the BCS interaction term, beside that number U, it's basically the mod square of this term, more or less, right? So that interaction term is the dagger of this times this thing. Right? Which means now you replace the BCS Hamiltonian. Yeah, it's written in the form of C dagger, C dagger, CC. So the idea you replace that with this thing. Okay. So this becomes a quadratic theory, at least you know how to solve, or when we can try to solve it. Okay. So this will become, let me just replace that volume times integral of dk by some summation over k. Delta star ck c minus k down. If you think this is long, it's really because you want to make everything singular. But at the end of the day, it's not going to be very important. I mean, it is important, but it's going to simplify. So it's really just this number times C dagger, which is here, and the star of this times CC.
Yes.
Yes.
So we don't keep the delta square?
Yeah, this is just a number. So let's sum plus some number. And this term, which we throw away. So the strategy, so before actually solving it, let me tell you what's the strategy. The strategy is that, we can now solve this, let me call this term the kinetic term. Right, so we can now solve this, let me call this mean field. Kinetic term plus the BCS mean field, which I will be doing for you in several minutes. But the thing is, this Hamiltonian is a quadratic one. It's quadratic in CC dagger, so it's solvable. So now solve this, and then what do you get? You get a theory for the ground state, for example. Let's say, for example, you solve the ground state. And then, in your ground state, you have an expectation of the CC operator, which you can compute from the solution of this. But then you want to do it self-consistently. You want to say that this U times this integral over dk, for example, is your delta. Remember, this Hamiltonian depends on the number delta. In this Hamiltonian, this delta is a parameter. So this expectation, the ground state will be a function of delta. And therefore, the expectation of this operator will be a function of delta. And at the end of the day, you want to remember that the definition of delta is the integral, the weighted integral of this operator taking expectation value. So as long as you impose this self-consistent condition, at least what you're doing is sensible. Okay. And of course, it may be that the only solution you can have is delta equal to zero. And that's it, that's a fine solution. That just means that this is not a terrific, it's not a very useful thing to do. You don't have to. So now let's try to do it. Of course, let me first also make the claim for you. You actually see the argument maybe later in the week that if delta is non-zero, you get superconductor. Okay. That's maybe tomorrow or even Thursday, but let's see. Okay, so that's the strategy. Wait. Okay. Yes.
What's like a if delta equals zero, like yes. Those like that describe the superconductor. So like what is the physical understanding of a delta?
Delta equal to zero means that so I'll actually show you that if you have a delta not equal to zero, it means this Fermi surface is actually unstable. The basic feature that you've seen for a Fermi surface, for example, the fact that you have a lot of low energy excitation. Right? You can create a hole here with very little energy or create a particle here causing very little energy. That feature will be gone if delta is not zero. So if delta end up being zero, that means the Fermi surface picture is stable. We actually get back the Fermi liquid theory.
Question.
Yes.
So that Mayfield approximation, can we relate it? So how is it related to the mean field approximation of the spins of considering?
Yeah, the idea is for any mean field, the logic is basically this. You have some complicated mess, right, for example. You don't know how to solve it. The only thing you know how to solve is something like this. Right, so where this h is a number. And then you say, aha, let me, you know, replace this by a number and then solve the one-body problem. And then I can, you know, put my answer back in and solve everything consistently.
And here
the analog of S is like CC operator. So my Hamiltonian is like the CC times its Hermitian conjugate. And then I say, okay, so I don't know how to solve this, but at least I can try to solve this. All right, of course, you can do multiple things. You can organize things a little bit and say you try to do this. And that's known as Hartree fork. You can certainly do that. I'm not doing that here just because for this problem, it's not particularly important, but you can certainly try to do it.
But we do get a bunch of terms, right? We get when we group the C dagger together, we get
yes.
When we group the C's together, we get.
Yeah, you get, so, sorry. You mean this? Yeah, you get a bunch of things. So this will just end up being a number. So it's a number in your Hamiltonian. So we don't particularly care. Well, at least within this approach. There's some other approach where you care. But this will be the residual term, right? So the assumption is that somehow the effect of this operator is sufficiently, you know, it's adequately captured by this expectation value. So the fluctuation on top of that expectation value is weak.
Oh, sorry. So that the fourth term, we're killing the fourth term, right?
Yes, we're throwing away the fourth term.
Sorry. I didn't realize that the fourth term, that wasn't an approximation. What was
yes,
it? Was just,
yes. If you keep the fourth term, it's an exact rewriting.
Okay.
So, yeah. Yes. Okay. Now let's solve it. Right. It's some quadratic theory, and momentum is conserved. So again, we go to. It's not that hard to rediagonalize. So you can write the mean field Hamiltonian. Remember, it's a function of delta. Right. As this. So let's only focus on momentums within this shell, because momentum out of the shell is kind of a free Fermi Hamiltonian. They're decoupled from momentum within the shell. So let's just do k with ck absolute value smaller than this omega d. Okay. Then you can rewrite this thing essentially as this. Some okay. Here I've used the fact that in that single term, if I switch k and minus k, and I basically get the same term. maybe a little bit more explicit. Right. There's a summation over k. Now, if I put this k equal to minus k in the summation, I and then I switch this to term, I get a minus sign, then I basically get the same term as here. So there's a factor of two that's being canceled after I do that. And then I get this term. So let me read the term for you. So this one is just, you know, the ck times c dagger k ck. This one is more or less that, except now I switched the order of c and c dagger, so there's a minus sign here. After that switch, there's an extra anti-commutator, but that's just a number. So I'm just absorbing that into a number. Okay. And this delta term, they are the BCS term in the mean field approximation. So this delta term, for example, connects this c dagger minus k with the c dagger k. Okay. And then likewise, this delta star connects these two. Okay. So this is pretty much an exact rewriting of the mean field Hamiltonian. And this object, the two-dimensional, the two-component Fermi operator is sometimes known as the Nambun spinner. It's like it's a spinner, right? It's two-component. Also, you should, and this is designed so that this thing carries a well-defined momentum and spin. This object actually carries momentum k and spin up. Right? You see a minus k amp down here, but there's a dagger. Right? So creating a momentum at minus k is like annihilating a momentum at minus k. So all the symmetries are there. So now the task is just essentially diagonizing some 2x2 Hub matrix, which you know how to do. So also another simplifying feature, which we don't really need, but the algebra becomes simpler if we do that. So let's do that. So let's assume that delta is real, so that we don't have to worry about delta and delta star, which even if it doesn't, you can always redefine this C or C dagger by a phase to make it real. Okay. So let's assume that it is real. And then what do we get? Well, first of all, this is like CK times a sigma Z, the Z polymatrix, times delta, if delta is real, times a X polymatrix. So the eigenvalue of that, which is the energy, say at momentum k, is plus minus square root ck squared plus delta squared. So by week three, this should look familiar in one way or another. This means that you get a gap, right? So originally, if delta is zero, what do you get? You get plus minus ck. That's just the particle hole continuum. So that's just saying, if I have a particle here, I get an energy ck, and if I have a particle here, I get energy minus ck. Sorry. Yeah, that's more or less right. But now there is a gap of delta. Yes.
Can you talk a little bit more about the Nambu spinners?
This.
Yeah, exactly. Can you talk a little bit more about them? I don't know their properties or why do you call them?
Oh, it's called spinner because it's two component. Right. The special thing about it is that one component looks like C and the other component looks like C dagger. So if you perform a U1 symmetry, it looks weird. It doesn't transform simply under the U1 rotation. Right. But if you suspend you'll worry about U1 symmetry for a little bit. It works as good as any other Fermi operator. Yeah.
what about the physical meaning of the eigenstate of this?
Sorry?
What about physical meaning of eigenstate? Because we have the number spinning.
Yes. Yeah, so okay, so you have to be a little bit careful here, actually. Yeah, so this minus sign actually really, if you go to the delta goes to zero limit, you see that this minus sign comes from the fact that I'm switching, for one of the spin components, it's spin down, I'm switching what I mean by particle and what I mean by hole. Right? So you have to be a little bit careful. For example, the ground state, you say, if you have a negative energy, normally you say you feel that state. But now the state that you feel is not a particle, but a hole. Filling a hole is like leaving a particle empty. So that's how you recover in the limit of delta goes to zero. That's how you recover the original Fermi surface picture.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I didn't understand the meaning of like redefine by a phase. Like, what does that mean? Like.
Oh. That's just saying. For example, if you have this number times a phase factor, so that the delta is not a real number times, for example, c dagger, right? Then you say, okay, I don't like this, so let me redefine things. Let me decide to call a c tilde dagger as, let's say, e to the what I theta over 2 c dagger.
But what would it mean in real, what would be the
phase? You redefine your Fermi operator by a phase. Right? It's like multiplying all the wave functions by a phase, the single particle wave function by a phase, which you always have the freedom to do. So this is exactly the U1 symmetry that we'll see is spontaneously broken in this paired state. But once you do this, it becomes like this. So at least you can always choose a basis to work with real delta. The thing is, you don't have to do that. Even if delta is complex, I mean, this is still just a simple 2x2 matrix. You can solve it. You see that you get pretty much the same result. Okay. All right, so that's the eigenvalue. And also now the eigenvectors, which it's not that hard to get either. So let me introduce this two symbols, gamma k up and so there are two factors that I'm introducing here, that's u and v. By the way, this u is not to be confused with that interaction u, it's just a number here. V k up. It's a bit annoying to keep track of all the spin indices, so if you can't do it in real time, that's fine. So you can always check on your own offline. Right. But it's at the end of the day, it's just diagonalizing some 2x2 matrix. So let me tell you what U and V look like. So U look like E is this E. E A plus C K over 2 E. And V K is minus okay. If you look at different books, sometimes they use slightly different sign convention, but otherwise, so these two numbers are known as coherence factors. So these are the eigenvectors of this Hamiltonian. So if you plug things in, this is literally just diagonizing Hamiltonian. What you see is that the H becomes K, EK, gamma K up, dagger, gamma K up, plus gamma K down. Yes.
Why are those called coherence vectors? Like, what, how?
It's some historical name. It has nothing to do with coherence.
Okay, so they don't, like, have some sort of physical?
Well, they do. They have physical consequences. It just has nothing to do with coherence. Yeah. But these two numbers will play an important role. So one thing is that If you stare at these two numbers, they square, you know, the sum of their square is 1. Right, so these two, you know, this transformation almost looks like an SO2 rotation. And because of that, you can check on your own that this gamma satisfy canonical commutation rule. Right. So this C dagger come with the canonical anti-commutation rule, and turns out that's preserved for gamma. So you also have things like gamma k alpha. Alpha is the spin, can be up and down. Gamma k prime beta is 0, and then gamma k gamma dagger k alpha gamma k prime beta is delta kk prime delta alpha beta.
Shouldn't there be a minus sign between both number operators? Because they correspond to precisely the...
Yeah, I secretly did a particle hole here. Yeah, so it turns out if you literally plug this into here, what you will get first is this. Yeah, and then I say, whatever, I do this. Yeah. The thing is, for a fermion operator, it doesn't really matter which one you call C, which one you call dagger. So it's designed. Okay. So for one thing, you know the spectrum now. The spectrum looks like this. Okay. So let me first draw the Okay, here's KF. The idea is, if I think about excitation in my theory, so if it's free fermion, if it's just that Fermi C, the excitation spectrum, say this is energy, looks like this. So near the Fermi C, I have this mode and this mode. So this is hole. I remember the energy is something like VF times K minus KF. So when it's negative, it means it's filled. So if I want to make an excitation, I make a hole. So the excitation energy is always positive, right? If I move across the Fermi surface in momentum, then the excitation energy spectrum will look like this for free Fermi gas. And what does this look like? Well, this look like. Like this. So if I'm far away from the Fermi momentum, it looks basically the same as the linear dispersion. But if I'm close to the Fermi energy, there is a gap, delta. Right. So this part is like, so this part of particle like, and this part is called hole. And these fermions have names. Well, everything has names. So these things are also known as Bogoliubov fermions. The funny thing about these fermions is that they're mixtures of C and C dagger. So if you ask how much electric charge they carry, you don't get a good answer. There's no well-defined electric charge. This part.
Okay. Why the whole level has the positive excitation energy?
Excitation energy, by definition, has to be positive because it's defined as the energy minus the ground state energy, right? So hole-like really means this: you're deleting a particle here within the Fermi C. You're paying energy. And this delta has a name of a pairing gap. So it's a gap, but it also has the property that it looks like you are pairing two fermions together. So that comes with the name. So okay, so we solved the Hamiltonian, but what does that mean? Let me give you a better idea by solving for you the ground state of that Hamiltonian. Well, what is the ground state of this Hamiltonian? Well, first of all, this EK, this EK is always positive. So since this is positive, that comes with a bunch of things that almost look like just ordinary free fermions. The ground state is a state for which all these positive energy fermion levels are empty. So so the ground state is defined by the property that all this gamma k, whether up or down, when it acts on this ground state wave function, should vanish, because that's the annihilation operator of a fermion state that's not occupied. Right. Now you just plug in the meaning of gamma k here and ask what that means. Right. So and by the way, the excited state will be something like acting on the ground state with a gamma dagger. It's just how you construct the excited state of the free fermion system. So then what does this gamma, this omega ground state look like? Well, it has the property that if I have a U, and let me think about a fixed momentum K, right? So for a fixed K, let's think about it. Then you have what, UC up minus VC down. So here, implicitly, when I write the C, I mean C at momentum K. And whenever I write a C dagger, it's C dagger at momentum minus K. Right. So I'm just omitting that index. I want this. So that's the gamma K up. Right. Also, I want that to be true for the gamma K down, which looks like this. So now you are dealing with only two fermion operators, C up and C down. Right, so two fermion operators span a Hilbert space of dimension 4, because each one gives you a Hilbert space dimension 2. This is essentially a four-state problem, and solving this equation. And then you can check on your own that the ground state, at least within this four-state Hilbert space, should look like U plus V C dagger up, C dagger down, zero. Where zero is the vacuum, where all the fermion C up, C down are unoccupied. So you can do a real quick check. For example, this operator, when it acts on that, right? So this C up acting on this component vanishes because it's already the unoccupied state. But this C up, when acting on this part, first of all, annihilate this guy. So actually, yeah, let me do a real check for you so that you know what I'm doing. So when it's acting on this one, so this part gives you U times this one times V, C up dagger and C up, they annihilate, and then you're left with this. Okay. And now minus V, again, V, this C dagger term acting on this vanishes because it's already fully occupied. So it can only act on this. So you get V times U times C down dagger. These two cancel. So that's the logic. And you can check that this one works. So that's for a fixed K. Now, do this for all K. What do you get? You get this ground state No, it's the product of all k times this uk plus vk ck up dagger c minus k. This is known as the Shriver wave function. So you can view this as a tri-wave function or variational wave function of the BCS Hamiltonian. We're not doing it that way, but suppose you do it that way, you'll get more or less the same result. So this is known. So what you are staring at is pretty much the most successful trial wave functions in the history of physics ever. So it's quite something. Okay. So let's get a better sense of what this looks like. So if I plot U and V, right, just by that expression, right, what does it look like? Well, U more or less look like this. So it's a function really of C, of the original kinetic energy. So let's plot it. So if C is very negative, right, so that if C is much, much larger than delta, then E and C are more or less the same number. Then this is one. Then E and C are more or less the same number, but of opposite signs. So this is basically zero. And likewise, this V will be plus one. So see that if it's very negative, C is negative, you get this. And if C is very positive, you can also check that number that is more or less one. Right? And then there is a crossover region. Delta minus delta, where it, you know, goes from 0 to 1. Actually, it's deeper than what I draw. Yeah, it's more like this. Okay. And likewise, this V factor up to some minus sign. I guess I defined it with a minus. So suppose I plot this. It looks like this. Again, very negative is one, very positive it's zero. So it's the opposite of that. Right. What does that mean? Well, it means that if I'm very deep within the Fermi C, for example, K is much smaller than the KF, then I can basically forget about this UK. It's pretty much just VK. That's basically one. But that's what you expect, right? If I'm well below delta, minus delta, then I should just feel the Fermi C. Essentially, my kinetic energy is much more important than that delta gap. So the result should be basically the same as the three Fermi C, which is just a bunch of field states. And likewise, if K is much larger than KF, right? From this, you see that V is basically zero and U is basically one. So that's just saying I should leave the states empty. So for energy scales much above or much below delta, it's basically the same as the free Fermi gas. And the funny thing only happens, you know, between around the scale delta. And actually, before we go for a break, let me just say that if I take that dispersion and ask about density of state, which is an important characterization of any low energy phase of matter, that, let me call it rho. And you can just plug in this dispersion relation. And what you will find is that it's n0. n0 is the original density of state of the Fermi C, which is a constant, if you remember, times this thing, delta. Which turn out to be this. So theta is the step function. It's zero if this number is negative and one if this is positive. So what does that look like? It looks like this. So it's diverging as you approach delta from above. Right, and this is the number, and zero, that's the constant density of state. If delta is zero, so you have a Fermi gas. Okay. So what happens is that before you turn on a delta, you have a constant density of state. So your total number of state, for example, from zero to let's say this here, this integral of this rectangle. But now with a finite delta, the states below the delta gap, you know, they disappear. There's no state below delta anymore, just by solving that, because that dispersion comes with a gap. But these states didn't go to nowhere. They have to go to somewhere, because it's number of states, right? That should conserve. What happened is this part becomes this part. So if you integrate the density of state, you should get the same number. Again, it's counting the total number of states. That shouldn't change.
So why when we have free fermions that the density of state is a constant?
No. So this is, yeah. Even though I'm drawing this way, this energy is still much below, much smaller than the Fermi energy. So I'm still looking at things only near the Fermi energy. Near the Fermi energy, the density of state is basically a constant. It varies slightly with energy, but that variation is high order. Right. Think of this as room temperature, for example, which is tiny compared to Fermi energy. Okay. All right, so let's take a break, and after five minutes, I'll actually fulfill my promise of doing the self-consistent calculation. So. Let's begin. So what is delta? Right. I've been using delta just as a number. So how do you solve it in some fashion? So as I said, we want to determine it self-consistently. So let's determine delta for the ground state. So the ground state looks like that, as I've shown you. So now for each momentum, you can ask, what is the expectation value of this? So what does this thing do, right, on this omega? If you stare at the form of omega, actually let me pull it down a little bit. Right. If you stare at the form of that, this one, right? So what this does is the non-vanishing part is this two CC act on the C dagger. And then when you take the expectation value, you take the inner product with the U part. Right. Which means this thing should be given by, or if you put in the signs correctly, this number, U times V. And if you plug in the form of U and V there, you see that it's square root of E squared minus C squared over 2e. But e squared minus c squared is just delta squared. So this is delta over 2e. So that's for each momentum k. Now the definition of delta, when you solve self-consistently, let me remind you, it's basically the momentum integral times 2. Well, there's a 2 because of that spin singlet factor. Because you have up, down, minus, down, up, essentially. Minus k down times u times that theta factor. Now you just plug in this into this number. What do you get? Well, you get Well, you get a number that depends on that depends on momentum only through the dependence on C. Because remember, E is something like C K squared plus delta squared. Right, so the only dependence is on the absolute value of the momentum. So the angular integral is quite simple here. So now you massage the algebra a little bit. Let me remind you that very often if things only depend on energy and doesn't depend on the angular integral, you can always convert an integration in momentum space into the density of state times the integration in energy. Right. So if you do that here, you get U, which is just a number here, times the density of state, times the integral in C, and then times this factor. And the two cancels this two, so you get delta over square root C squared plus delta squared. Now what's the integration domain? Because this phase factor, like C, only integrates from minus omega d to plus omega d. Yes?
We have a question. Could you talk a bit more about why the divide frequency appears as a cutoff, and does it have to do with electron phonon sketch?
Yes. Yeah, I was going to say this later, but eventually, yes. So essentially for real model, if you think, okay. You can ask, where does this interaction come from? In real metal, in the simplest case, which is the most conventional case, that BCS interaction comes from the electron phonon interaction. And phonons only become actively scattering with electrons below the energy scale known as the Debye frequency. Essentially, if I'm above Debye frequency, the phonons are too slow to catch up with my electron. Right. So the Debye frequencies serve as a natural energy cutoff for that interaction. I'll be saying a little bit more later, maybe tomorrow, I think.
So why don't we use N0 instead of rho E?
No, this is just a rewriting of the integration. Right. So I'm integrating in K and taking something that only depends on C. Right. Delta is just a number here. Yeah, so.
So I'm asking why the density of state is not rho E but N0, just N0.
Because this one is something like the angular integral K squared dk, something like that, right? So now you just rewrite dk as something like dc over something, and then the rest, yeah. It's purely just phase space counting. So, so this integral you can play with yourself and train your integration muscle a little bit, and then realize that it's log of this thing. Sorry, times delta. Which is actually not that hard to anticipate. So this delta pulls out, it's a constant, so that's the factor. And now if you stare at this dx over c squared plus delta squared, realize that if this omega is large, then it's like dx over c, which has a log divergence. Right. So so that's the log, with the divergence eventually cut off by that finite omega. So this form is not that hard to anticipate. Well, what does this mean? Well, first of all, if you look at this number, it's positive definite. Right. And which means that Well, first of all, delta equal to zero is always a solution of this equation, trivially. But the question is there a non-trivial solution? Well, immediately you conclude that a non-trivial solution exists only if u is positive. Because otherwise, you divide by delta is 1 equal to some negative number,
which makes no sense.
And this is anticipated because if you look at that BCS interaction, I've thrown away the constant piece. But if you put it back, it's something like, minus delta square over u of that form. Right? There's some integration and so on. Which means if u is positive, you anticipate delta, you know, to be non-zero to you know, minimize the energy, to lower the energy for ground state. But if u is negative, you don't want any delta, right, to have lowest energy. So it is anticipated. And I'll show you later that in practice, this means that the interaction is attractive. The sign of u I chose means that. And if it's repulsive, meaning u smaller than zero, you don't expect this delta to actually be non-zero. Yes?
Could you just write down what omega b is, what it stands for?
It's the energy scale I used to specify the BCS interaction, right? Remember my rule was that, okay, I erased that. The rule is that the electrons, this kind of scattering, let's see. So suppose this is my Fermi surface. Then the rule is the scattering only happens within a thin shell of the Fermi surface. Right? So for example, if I have two particles here with opposite momentum, then they can scatter to another two particles also within this shell. But if I have two particles here, then my interaction don't do anything. So they just stay. So that's the rule of gain, if you like. It turns out to be a pretty good rule of gain. So this thing has a momentum scale, delta k, which the energy scale, I call it omega d. Right. So that's the width of that shell. Okay. Practically, it comes from, for simple metal, that comes from electron-phonon interaction, which is why that thing is called omega d. It really means the bifrequency. But there are models which that energy cutoff come from other energy scale. And this is a pretty good model in practice for electron-phonon coupling, because far above omega d, the electron-phonon coupling turns out to be quite ineffective. So, but at this point, it's just a number. Yes?
There's a u in the integrand and there's not a u in the measure. So we have a u.
Sorry, what? Which one?
There's another u in the integrand already.
Yes? This one?
Second u that we get in the measure. So we have.
No. There is a u here. There's no. No. This u is not the same, right? This u is the. Is this coherence factor. Yeah, so there is only one u here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, is it delta always bigger than u?
Not necessarily, actually. Actually, usually smaller.
Why?
You see. Actually, now you solve this, right? You see that typically it's smaller. Now solve this, right? Assume a non-trivial solution, which means delta non-zero, so then you eliminate this delta. What do you get? Well, So also let me assume, which is often true, pretty much always true in this kind of model, that omega d is much larger than delta. If I make that assumption, then this expression simplifies quite a bit. Essentially, if the omega d is much larger than delta, this expression is more or less omega d. So the numerator becomes 2 omega d. But downstairs, you have omega d minus omega d, so you need to look at the next order, which is delta squared over 2 omega d. So now you get a very simple solution, which is delta approximately equal to 2 omega d times e to the minus 1 over u times n0. That's a central result of the BCS theory. Okay. So as promised, several comments. The first is that if you look at this expression, you see that as long as u is larger than zero, this solution makes sense. Right? Even if u is very small, you still get some non-zero delta. Yes.
This assumption omega d is much greater than delta. What is the physical intuition for?
The intuition is that at omega d, your attractive interaction kicks in, but then it takes a very long time for an actual gap to develop. Now, if you know RG, time means RG time. All right, so some comments. First one is this pairing instability. Well, the reason it's called instability is because now your Fermi surface structure qualitatively changes. The density of state is no longer a constant. Right? There is a gap above which you start to have states, actually. So this pairing instability happens for any u greater than zero, even if u is very weak. So this is sometimes also known as a weak coupling instability or perturbative instability. Remember last time when we talked about Landau Fermi liquid, I said that usually you expect an interaction to destroy the Landau Fermi liquid picture, low energy quasi particles and so on, only if you have sufficiently strong interaction. But an interaction of this BCS form doesn't obey that rule. Even an infinitesimal one will eventually, at low enough energy, kill your Fermi surface. And another thing is delta as a function of u is not analytic. I mean, just look at that. Which means it cannot be obtained perturbatively. Obtained in perturbation theory. Or specifically perturbation theory in u. Right, because any perturbation theory always end up giving you a power series in U. Now expand that expression in power series in U. You get 0 plus 0 plus 0, all the way 0. Right, so this is beyond naive perturbation theory. Naive perturbation, even if u is small. Which makes sense, because when we say u is small, small compared to what? Right, compared to Fermi energy, fine. But then we're looking at energy scale even smaller than u itself. It's that tiny energy scale. If u is small, that number is tiny. Right. So that there's always an energy scale below which you can't treat U as small, basically. And then turns out your perturbation theory will inevitably fail. You get something like that. Yes.
Could you explain again why you called in point zero a pairing instability?
Yeah. So if U is non-zero, that essentially means that schematically you have this, right? In fact, you can be a little bit more precise and show that that expression, if you Fourier transform back in real space, it's more or less this expression. Right, it means that your electrons at different with different spins are actually paired. In fact, we'll see that the better way to say it is it's pair condensed. Or you can look at that Schreiber wave function and see that in that wave function, the electrons either don't appear or appear as pairs of with opposite momentum and spin. And to make an excitation, you have to actually break a pair. And the excitation looks like this. Yeah, the important thing is the qualitative feature of the Fermi surface is gone. And that's why it's called an instability. Because remember last time we said the main feature of the Fermi surface is you have lots of low energy excitations, namely the quasi-particles that cause very little, you know, the energy cost to create them is of order k minus kf, which is tiny. You'll go close to the Fermi surface, right? And that feature is gone. So you can no longer view that as the usual Fermi gas. Actually, let me also say that typically, by the way, many of this will become clearer when we talk about, you know, physical properties of this. For example, if I shoot a current, does it decay? If I turn on a magnetic field, what happens? And then you will see more clearly that it's clearly a weirder state than the metal. So we'll get there. But typically, let me say that in simple metals, Fermi energy is by far the largest scale. It's of order 10,000 Kelvin, sometimes even larger. And that's why room temperature is considered very cold. And Debye frequency is typically of order room temperature, 300, 400, several hundred. Right. And typically within this framework, delta is probably of order 10 Kelvin or even smaller, like a few Kelvin or something. So this hierarchy, which we implicitly assume there, is satisfied in usual method. Yes.
By the way, just talking about temperature,
yes.
Omega D depend on temperature?
Sorry?
If my system, would omega D depend on the temperature?
Weakly. So since things happen at pretty low temperature, you can pretty much take the omega D at zero temperature. But for example, the effective omega D will change. Let's say if you raise from zero to room temperature, typically it changes. But it doesn't change drastically either. Let's say you change from something like 300 to 200 or something. Right. And by the way, that, yeah, if you stare at this, this expression, you realize that if you want the delta to be larger, then typically you either want to have a larger omega d, a Debye frequency, or a larger u, or the density of state. Right. It turns out the highest you can go is something like metallic hydrogen. For hydrogen, because the atom is so light, that the atoms can wiggle quite, you know, in a quite fast pace. So omega D correspondingly is pretty large. That's actually the highest temperature superconductor we can get, almost room temperature. All right, so that's the gap. Actually, let me see. Actually, let me quickly solve for you what happens at finite temperature. Right. So what does this look like? Well, the thing is, I've reduced this this Hamiltonian to a quadratic Hamiltonian. So in principle, at any finite temperature, you can solve it. It's just a free fermion problem at finite temperature, just with a weirder dispersion. Right? So we know that at finite temperature, one thing we know is the occupation number of those Bogoliubov fermion. Should be given by the standard Fermi distribution, essentially. Except in this exponential factor, you should use Ek over T plus 1. So as T goes to 0, it becomes essentially 0. Because E is positive definite. So T goes to 0, this one always vanishes. And then that's the ground state property. But any finite temperature, you can do this. Also, since that thing is just literally as a gamma dagger gamma, then this gamma k, gamma minus k expectation will be 0. Now you plug things in. What do you mean? Well, we know, essentially, you now take the inverse of this transform, right? So let me do the algebra for you. It looks like ck up is uk gamma k up plus vk gamma minus k down, ck minus k down is uk gamma minus k down minus vk gamma dagger. Sorry, there's a dagger. K up. Okay. You can check the algebra on your own, but it's just some linear trend. Well, that means what? Now if I want to, again, self-consistently solve the BCS equation, something of that sort, right? So I need the expectation of CK up C minus K down. Now essentially plug this into here and then use this thing. What do you get? Well, you see that you will get something like UK VK times minus 1 plus gamma K up dagger gamma K up plus gamma minus K down dagger gamma minus K down. So this minus 1 essentially come from the fact that when I have this, there is a gamma gamma dagger. So if I move that and become gamma dagger gamma, there's a minus one from this canonical anti-commutation, gamma dagger and gamma. And this is the right result because the ground state, remember, ground state has all this gamma dagger gamma being zero. So ground state means I get minus UK VK, which is what I had there. Right, so the zero temperature result makes sense.
Consider clearly, is it cat minus?
Sorry. It's the expectation of this operator.
It's a minus one.
Oh, it's minus one.
Yeah, it's minus
one.
Yeah, minus one.
Okay.
So now you just plug it in. What do you get? Well, you get, again, UK VK is something like delta over 2E. And this number, minus UK VK is delta over 2E, and then you get 1 minus 2 over e to the e over t plus 1. Now again, put it into that expression. What do you get? You get delta, now as a function of temperature. Because delta is just a parameter in my mean field Hamiltonian. So it doesn't have to be temperature independent. In fact, it will be temperature dependent. For example, if I go to very high temperature, let's say you know, much higher than the original delta I calculated, right? Then the kinetic energy will mostly be of order temperature. So delta is no longer important. It's very hard to imagine that delta will still play any role. So it's expected to be temperature dependent. And then you can still solve that within the self-consistent approach. So now let me just write down for you. Essentially, you have almost the same equation as before, except for this factor that involves temperature, 1 minus 2 over e to the square root delta square plus c square over t plus 1. Right. Everything else is, beside this factor, everything else is. So this is known as the BCS gap equation. So one thing you can see from this gap equation is that delta T goes down as temperature raises. Right, because if temperature is zero, this factor, this thing is zero, so you just get one. But if temperature raises, this thing becomes non-zero, this thing is smaller than one, so you get a smaller number. So we anticipate. So we anticipate there is a critical temperature TC above which delta is just zero. So above that temperature, you basically get your normal metal back. So which means I want set delta equal to zero plus infinitesimal, if you like. Then I get the equation for TC, which is 1 equal to U and 0. Remember, when delta equal to 0, this equation also simplifies. I mean, in general, for a given t, this equation is not easy to solve analytically. You can solve it numerically, actually. But if you want an analytic solution, it can be done if delta is 0. And then you get something like this. Then you solve it. You get TC is basically 0.57 times the gap at zero temperature. Remember, the gap at zero temperature is that 2 omega d times this exponential factor. So TC is of the same order with the gap, which makes sense, right? Because there's no other energy scale that's natural here. So in general, what you will see, you plot the gap as a function of temperature. At zero, you get some gap. And then it goes like this. So at some TC of this order, the gap vanishes. And above which, the gap is identically zero, and it looks just like a normal metal. And below you get a BCS gap. Okay, so I think I don't have time to actually start anything new. But next time, I will actually tell you roughly where does this BCS interaction come from. In particular, there is a puzzle I want to resolve for you, which is I haven't shown you, but you can see for yourself, and I will show you next time that if I want U to be positive, which gives me a BCS instability, then then it better come from some kind of attractive interaction between the electrons. And I've told you that electron-phonon interaction can induce an effective attraction between electrons. I'll show roughly what it looks like next time. But there is the puzzle that we know electrons, deep down, they repel each other. There's the Coulomb repulsion. And if you look at any typical metal, and if you just plug in the number, the Coulomb repulsion typically wins over any effective attraction induced by electron-phonon interaction. But somehow still, at the very end of the day, electron-phonon seem to win for many of the metals, not all, but for many of the metals. So how does that come about? So I'll show you that next time. And then after that, I think we're ready to actually talk about spontaneous symmetry breaking Landau-Ginzburg theorems. Yes.
I think I missed something about your critical temperature here.
Yes.
You said, so the critical temperature is 0.57 times the delta?
Times the delta defined at temperature zero. So that's the delta I solved for this. That's the ground state delta.
Oh, okay.
So the delta, if I raise temperature, should change. And then the statement is at this temperature, delta vanishes.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, actually, a brief survey. Have you seen Landau theory before?
No.
No, not in your seminar.
I haven't.
Okay. Good.
Much for everyone else.
No. But yeah, that's all I need to know. Because if it's covered in Pedro's course, then I can save some work. But okay. Yes.
At the very beginning, you just told me the last term.
That term?
Yeah.
That's the fluctuation term.
Actually, for me, I thought it's kind of like Coulomb fluctuation.
Sorry?
It's kind of fluctuation.
It is fluctuation above the mean field.
It's principle that should like finally affect our result.
Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Typically in 3D, it doesn't do too much. In lower dimension, it may do something. In fact, in 1D, that fluctuation will completely invalidate everything I said.
Is there any like simple physical pictures to show the master of this kind of function?
Yeah, it can be. Okay. Showing it seriously is hard. I mean, it's. But it can be shown in some way within the Landau-Ginzburg approach. So let me talk about that next time, or Thursday.